Let's call this meeting back to order. And what we want to do first is we want to move House File 3377 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Report. And we'll lay that over. Next up for us will be House File 3241, Representative Coonan. Check that. Just a second, Representative Coonan. I talked to Representative Liebling, and she has something she needs to get to, so let's go to House File 3773 if we could.
Yeah, that's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Coonan. Mr. Chair, did you move on? I'm on the Tax Committee, but I'm not a member of this division.
Representative Liebling, I'll move House File 3773 for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for hearing this. Members, although this relates to sales tax, it is not any kind of sales tax extension. What it is basically, last year, Rochester had authorization for an additional 1% additional lodging tax and food and beverage tax, and that was specifically earmarked just to pay the local portion of a bonding project for Rochester, which was in the bill this year but got vetoed. But we're hopeful that we're going to be able to bring this back and do it next year. What we're asking for here is just to have a bit more flexibility in using that existing authorized funding to finance bonds. And what this is intended to do is just make this a little bit less expensive for the city to do. So that's all. It doesn't extend the authorization in any other way. And I have with me Gary Newman, who's the Assistant City Administrator for Rochester. I'm going to turn it over to him, and I hope I explained it correctly.
Thank you, Representative Levy. Gary Newman, or Mr. Newman, please.
Members of the committee, Section 2A, all it does is it will still be a revenue bond, but it'll have a GO pledge to it, so we get a lower interest rate. That's really what's happening in Subdivision 2A. And then in Subdivision 3, it allows a possible refunding issue in case the revenues lag for a bit. You can refinance the remaining principal. These are two changes suggested by our bond counsel and our financial firm in order to make, in today's market, if you do sell bonds, bondholders get a little nervous that they have as much flexibility as possible. So these are just two technical changes to those.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Is there anyone in the audience that is for this bill or against this bill that would like to speak? Is there any discussion from our members? If not, I'll move House File 3773 for possible inclusion or into the Property Tax Division Report. Thank you, Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Representative Coonan.
Now, Representative Coonan has House File 3241. Representative Coonan, would you like to move your file?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move that House File 3241 be considered for inclusion in the Property Tax Division report.
Thank you, Representative Coonan. Why don't you go ahead and present your bill to us?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. If you've been reading the bill, you can see that it does include a local option sales and use tax. I've had a discussion with Chairman Marquardt about the bill, and we come to an understanding that the committee would only be considering the lodging tax and the food and beverage tax portion of this bill for inclusion in the division report. What the bill does is impose by ordinance a 1.5% of gross receipts for lodging, and also on the food and beverage tax, impose by ordinance an additional sales tax of 1.5%, and this is for consumption on the premises by restaurants and places of refreshment. And the use of the lodging tax and the food and beverage tax will be for, well, first of all, Marshall will use it to pay the cost of collecting and administrating the tax and to pay all or part of the operating costs of the new and existing facilities of the Minnesota Emergency Response and Industry Training Center, and also included with that the Southwest Minnesota Regional Amateur Sports Centers, and it will also include a payment of debt service on bonds issued for these projects. The taxes will expire whichever comes first, and this is the language in the bill at this time. It will expire either at 15 years or when the Marshall City Council determines that the revenues received are sufficient for the cost of the projects. And since the staff has brought this to my attention, Pat Dalton brought this to my attention, that since the sales and use tax portion of this will not be considered, that we may have to extend the time that the lodging tax and the food and beverage tax can be in effect. And I'll work with the City of Marshall and the committee and the chairman on that as we put the division report together, but that's just to let the committee know what's going on. And I have two representatives from Marshall here with me, representing Marshall in different capacities, and they will introduce themselves as they speak.
Thank you, Representative Kuhn, and testifiers. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Ben Mardig, City Administrator. I do have a number of people I want to just mention briefly that came along with a long trip from Marshall. We have the Community Services Director from Marshall, Harry Wylagi, and Rob Yant, our Public Safety Director, who are here. And then here testifying is Cal Brink. He's the Chamber Director for the Marshall Area Chamber of Commerce.
I just need you to repeat your name again.
Ben Mardig, City Administrator. M is Mary, A-R-T-I-G.
Thank you.
We do have the Chamber Director here, and we do believe that our project is generating a lot of local support. In fact, we've got a resolution of support in a number of businesses, U.S. Bank's large facility in town, regional wind training operation in the region, too, that are supportive of this project. And so we're really geared towards economic development on both of these projects. It should bring money not only to Marshall, but into the greater region of Southwest Minnesota and to the state of Minnesota through the combination of these projects. We're kind of on the front lines of South Dakota and here on WCCO every day about trying to attract our businesses out of Minnesota, and we're on the front lines of that. They have similar types of facilities just over the border down the road from us in Brookings and Sioux Falls, and they have sales tax on things that we don't have it on, and so we believe that that there's a lot of support and that these are good projects for us. Both of them are capital projects. They're included in your packet. It's the color handout that's in there. This was originally submitted from the initial proposal and includes some bonding money. We did receive some funding for our Merit Center, did not enter amateur sports, but we're still moving ahead. Again, both of these projects have state ties. One, the amateur, we're part of the Amateur Sports Commission. We're the Southwest Minnesota region of your Amateur Sports Commission. We were supported on the bonding project out of that group this year. Didn't receive funding, but we'll continue to look at our long-term plan for investing in that. And on our Public Safety Training Center, the statewide master plan has us as a Tier 2 facility. We're one of two in the state of Minnesota to cover the southwest region of the state. This would be an expansion of an existing facility to include some driving track facilities that we believe will be greatly utilized based on a business plan that we completed a number of years ago. Again, as Representative Kuhn indicated, they're both regional projects of significance. We believe that the sales tax is appropriate because of that regional benefit that as a major retail center for Southwest Minnesota, where Marshall generates about a trade area of about 40 to 50 miles, our daytime population doubles to 20,000 during the day with an employment. We have studies that indicate that we're generating substantially more sales tax revenues than would be anticipated based on the University of Minnesota study. And we continue to see some positive things with our economy, too, with unemployment being the lowest in the state at about 4% according to March figures. And we've seen some good positive news that our 2008 sales tax appears to have grown, actually, from 07 by 3.1%. So we know these projects are important to us. We can get into them in detail. But, again, we do understand that there's some concern with the other tax, and so we are requesting your support to move ahead with the 1.5%. With that, again, I turn it over to Cal Brink, maybe to comment on the community support from the Chamber of Commerce perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you could...
Cal Brink, the Marshall Area Chamber of Commerce Executive Director. And my role here, I thought, would be just to, rather than Ben tell you that there is support within the city, I represent the voice of over 300 members in our Chamber of Commerce, and just to kind of give you an idea of what our procedure would be on something like this is I presented the full program, the entire thing that you're looking at, this handout, to our board of directors as well as all of our committee members, which is about 70 people in all, who then took it out to our 300 members, and before we would give the letter of endorsement back to Ben and the city. So I'm here basically to say that our business community fully supports what we're talking about here, and we think that it's a great way to move Marshall forward.
Thank you for that. Representative Coonan.
That's the bill, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and we ask for your support. As was made clear earlier, these are regional projects, and it's very important to Southwest Minnesota. It's not just Marshall itself, but the whole portion of the state. And so just ask for the committee support. And
thank you, Representative Coonan. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify for or against? Please come forward and say your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Bagnoli. I'm an attorney with McGranche Law Firm, and I represent the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, Trade Association of Bars and Liquor Stores throughout the state. I'm actually not coming to testify for or against the bill. I'm coming just to make a couple of observations in advance of what I think is going to be a larger conversation about liquor taxes next year. So this is a little bit of laying the groundwork for what I think will be next year. I've heard said, even as recently as 2 hours ago, that we haven't raised the liquor tax in Minnesota since 1987. This is raising the liquor tax in Minnesota. Representative Liebling, in this particular community, Representative Liebling's bill that just sought to extend it or change the uses, in 2009 that was passed. So in Rochester, the liquor tax was raised last year, in 2009, 2 years ago. This will raise the liquor tax in Marshall to 10.875%. That's what it will be paid for. In Boston right now, it's 5%. In New York City, it's 8.75. In Los Angeles, it's 9.25. In Miami, it's 10%. We are above all major metropolitan. Well, the city of Marshall will be above what many would consider the major destinations. I offer this just only as observation in advance of what I think is going to be a fuller conversation next year. Thanks. I have no, and I'm sure that the chamber represents the folks out there. This is subject to a vote. I talked to Representative Coonan before. I don't mean to disparage or want to question his bill or the people from Marshall. I just want to make the larger observation in advance of what I think is going to be a robust discussion next year regarding taxes on alcohol. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just if House staff just really quickly could refresh my recollection on law, when is a referendum required for food and beverage, for lodging, and for general sales tax? I think I've got it straight what the default is, but if you just run through those three of when a referendum is required or not, or unless we grant an exception, of course.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, generally speaking, there's no statutory provision that requires a referendum for anything other than the general local sales taxes. So generally, we have not required a referendum for the food and beverage taxes, the amusement taxes, or the lodging taxes.
Thank you.
Representative Marcheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that point, just thinking about these, all these bills, not Representative Coonan's, but, all of them that are on the list today, and I'm just trying to, think about why do these just keep coming here, you just keep trying to kill them, but they just keep coming back. And I understand that the cities are looking for creative financing tools, and they would probably argue in part it's due to loss of other forms of intergovernmental revenue for many LGA, for others something else. But some of the things I think about with this is I really do think part of the problem here is the governor will sign them. And people have figured that out. People think that the governor won't sign taxes, but he signs all these. Since I've been here, I think of the 23 taxes we have, I think he's signed about 17 of them. And so I think, you know, this is an ongoing concern that this committee has to get its head around. You know, I know the committee members are aware that while it is true that the general sales tax requires a referendum, notably all of those that live in Hennepin didn't get that opportunity for the Twin Stadium, and the sales tax was raised on all of us for 30 years without a vote. So there's a lot of issues out here. It's going to be raised again with the Viking Stadium. But, you know, I guess I'd like to have Ms. Dalton, just maybe if it's okay with the chair, just talk to the committee just generally. The general sales tax, I think, is a different animal. I think food and beverage taxes and lodging have purposes for convention centers and things like that. Why don't we just let cities explicitly do lodging and food and beverage whenever they want? Why come here? You know, as long as we would require they would stay along with the streamlined sales tax, it seems that those, since we, you know, they all get, they pretty much get through and they get signed. Have we considered that as a legislature? Not general sales tax, lodging, food and beverage.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blancheski, we actually do have authority statewide for lodging taxes, for up to a 3% lodging tax. And I am guessing that it was probably enacted because we had a number of cities coming in and more cities coming in. So there was a movement, and there is a provision that basically allows any city or town to impose up to a 3% sales tax. It has to be used for a specific purpose, though. It's for tourism and convention bureaus and for promoting tourism. Why don't we have food and beverage taxes, and why don't we have admissions taxes generally? Nobody's proposed them. One issue, I think, is what Representative Blancheski is driving at, is back in 1971, Minnesota Miracle, when the state essentially authorized the local government aid programs, there was a trade-off in the local government aid programs, and that was the prohibition against sales taxes, local sales and income taxes. Clearly, that prohibition hasn't stood the test of time very well because, as we said, there's 23 general-purpose local sales taxes. Lodging taxes exist. The potential for lodging taxes exists throughout the state. There's about 120 cities who have a lodging tax at this point, and there is probably another dozen or more of the liquor taxes, food and beverage taxes, and admissions taxes throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Representative Koonin, any final words?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I understand all the discussion going on around here, but when the City of Marshall and Southwest Minnesota look at how to fund these things, I mean, the options are somewhat limited, and so we find ourselves looking at these types of funding mechanisms. The projects are very important to Southwest Minnesota, so I ask the committee to look favorably upon this bill as we put together the division report. And other than that, I want to say thanks to the committee for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Koonin. I'll lay over House File 3241 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Thank you. Okay, next up is House File 3737, Representative Poppy. And Representative Poppy, do you have someone that would move your bill?
I do not. Can you just ask that you do that, please?
Yes, I'll move. Representative Blancheski will move House File 3737 for possible inclusion. Representative Poppy.
Thank you. This is a Poppy Davids bill in front of you. We have an issue that we would like to have corrected. There is a request. House File 3737 extends the 4C property classification, which would include some areas in southern Minnesota specifically. That's what we're asking for. To include the property to be subject to the seasonal recreational state general tax rate rather than the commercial industrial state general tax rate. And I'm going to turn it over to Representative David so he can give some introductory comments, and then we have a couple of testimonies.
Thank you. Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the chair of the Tax Committee. We are uniters in southern Minnesota, not dividers. This is not an extension of a sales tax. This is a provision that was passed last year in the tax bill, and I would like to turn it over to the, so that this is not a new issue. This was passed before this committee. It was last year, and then through the House floor, and went to the governor. Of course, the governor vetoed the bill in its entirety. So that being said, I would turn it over to Mr. Lehman and Ms. Keeney to describe what they're trying to do here.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the tape, please.
Julie Keeney, spelling K-I-E-H-N-E. Hello, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to this topic this afternoon. I'm the director of the Lanesboro Area Chamber of Commerce, and in Lanesboro, we are a small historic tourist town, population 788, and we have primarily privately owned non-franchised businesses. We have worked with our legislators, as Representative Greg Davids just referenced, for the last couple years. We have testified before both the House and the Senate committees, working to rewrite the language of this Class 4C, seasonal recreational residential property tax classification, to be fair and inclusive of small business owners. Commercial tax rates on our seasonal businesses are not feasible for the businesses in our area. The current law limits our business. It is affecting over half of the rooms in Lanesboro. Requiring the two-night stays is frustrating not only for our customers, but also for our business owners, and they are actually turning business away. We want to be able to accommodate our customers, and turning away a business has a trickle-down effect not only locally for us as a city, but also for the state. And this is a time when we should be stimulating business in the state rather than turning it away. The current law written speaks specifically of northern Minnesota. There have been unintended consequences that have a negative effect on tourism and our southern part of the state. We are requesting language changes to make this law more equitable across the state. We have letters of support from both the Lanesboro Area Chamber of Commerce, which is an organization of 130 members, as well as our city council and mayor. And I'm hearing a statement from our mayor, Steve Braun. The economy of the city of Lanesboro is heavily dependent upon tourism, including the income earned by businesses operating lodging facilities in the city. Unfortunately, current tax policy, unfairly applied to the city of Lanesboro and others like it, is causing significant harm to that lodging industry. And for this reason, the City Council and City of Lanesboro asks you to sponsor this new proposed language, of which we have shared today. So we appreciate your time and consideration of the new language, because this will directly impact the success of our businesses in our area.
Thank you, Ms. Keeney.
Yes, thank you.
Rick Lehman, small business owner in Lanesboro. Last name is spelled L-A-M-O-N.
Thank you. Please present.
If I mess up on the protocol, you have to realize this is my first time doing this. So I've been watching, and I think it's Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Right. Nice.
Thank you.
I'll try to remember to finish with that at the end.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today to talk to this committee. I go back to the early 80s in Lanesboro, and actually I served on a committee in Lanesboro by the organization called Lanesboro Industries. And this trail came into Lanesboro, and I'm not sure what year it came in. Greg probably would know it, at mid-80s, somewhere in there, 85. Well, anyway, you guys were gracious enough to dedicate some funds to do that for the community, and this committee then, for about 3 years, we talked about how can we get some overnight lodging in Lanesboro. We had a trail, we had people coming to the community, and we didn't have any overnight lodging in the community. Communities of 2,500 or less typically would not have overnight lodging unless there were some unique feature that was required, and we were one of those. Today, I'm sure you're very well aware that we have have a number of lodging, overnight lodging facilities in the community. But the trail is really the reason, the recreational trail is the reason that we do have, excuse me, the lodging in Lanesboro. Now, one of the things that we probably didn't understand when we started that lodging was the seasonal nature of it, and I think we were under the impression that this would be a year-round kind of a thing for the businesses, and it's really proven that it is very much seasonal. You make your revenues between May 1 and October 30th. It's about a six-month period of time. I'm guessing, I won't ask you to raise your hands or anything, but I'm guessing that in this room there are a number of people that have visited Lanesboro, and I'm also guessing that you probably have visited Lanesboro in that May 1 to October 30th window, unless you happen to be one of the few cross-country skiers that come down into that area. I think we probably have about 100 bikers for every cross-country skier, but the point is, it's very seasonal. The trail makes it recreational. The lodging provides for the accommodation for these recreational bikers and other recreational sports as well, but it is a six-month period of time. The thing that has happened in Lanesboro is, and other small communities, I would presume as well, on the seasonal recreational classification is we're trying to fit ourselves into the language that was probably developed years and years ago for the northern Minnesota lake resorts. And it's kind of like taking a round plug and putting it in a square hole, I guess, using that as an analogy. What we're looking for is language that would meet our needs, that makes it clear, it's well-defined, it doesn't become confusing to business owners, it doesn't become confusing to the county. And just give you an example, and I'm going to, Julie alluded to this, but one of the things that's in the present language for the Northern Resorts, it talks about two-night minimum bookings. And if you can imagine, we have somebody call, maybe one of you have called our facility in Lanesboro, and you want to come down and stay for one night, and we're going to tell you, we're sorry, we can't take your reservation unless you're going to commit to two nights. And the reason that we do that is so that we can get this round plug into that square hole. And it just doesn't seem reasonable you should have to do that kind of thing. So there's about three things in the bill. You have to be under 2,500 in population. If you've got lodging and you're under that, it probably is due to the recreational reason. It eliminates this two night minimum situation. And Julie, you got to help me out. But the other two items that are in there would be what? Yeah, 2,500, oh, 20 or fewer rooms. I mean, we're not talking about a Holiday Inn or anything like that. These are ma and pa businesses down there. Oh, 250 days, and that's where this seasonal comes in. I mean, you think about that. We're saying we're only going to rent rooms 250 days out of the year. If we rent a single room in our nine-room facility for a 251st day, then we would not be eligible in this classification just by renting the one room. So you can see why we're looking for some clarity and some definition for this, and something that's going to fit our situation in southeastern Minnesota. And believe me, we are very grateful that you guys have provided this trail system in Minnesota, and it certainly has to be good, I would think, across the state as far as revenue for the state is as well. So with that, I'm going to say, Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you again. We do appreciate your time.
And thank you, Mr. Lehman, for your words. Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, as I'm sure you're aware, Lanesboro is the bed and breakfast capital of the state of Minnesota, officially designated and these changes would really help their situations. They're small mom-and-pop operations, 20 rooms or less, and it does not seem reasonable that they have to be stuck in a situation where they have to have two nights reservations. I mean, who cares? I mean, if somebody comes down for one night, we should be able to accommodate them there. So we'd really appreciate your support, Representative Papiani, on this provision.
Well, is there any other discussion round table, anyone? Anyone in the audience that's for or against this? Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reed Heidelberger. I'm the city assessor for the city of Alexandria, appearing before you today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. The Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, or NAO, we have in our mission statement, there's a policy statement that says, the association feels a good tax policy treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner, and MAO composes classifications or programs that target only a small number of taxpayers. In light of that position, we do have some concerns about the language in this bill and changes to the 4C classification. And a little bit of history here. When the 4C classification was originally developed, it came out of work between members of the legislature and representatives of the resort association. And the intent or what they were trying to do was define what were the quote-unquote true resorts. That is the longer-term stay recreation destination type establishments as opposed to short-term transient establishments, more like hotels, motels. This proposed change would tend to erode that distinction by bringing a small segment of the hotel-motel industry into the resort classification. We believe that this would create a significant inequity by giving an unfair competitive advantage to certain entities in the motel and hotel industry by moving them from that commercial class rate to the seasonal rec class rate. And we also believe that this would in turn create pressure from the industry to open up the definition even more for those that are not fitting within this so that they could get into it as well, and that would erode the distinction even further. I know in my own jurisdiction, for example, I've heard from several hotels and motels recently about how they've suffered during the recent recession, and if they were to see this change, I know one of the first things they would ask me is, well, why not us? Why can't we get in on this too? And I know there are examples in the state where you could have a unit across the street that would qualify for this. On the other side of the street, there might be a unit of 22 units would not meet this. So there would be an inequity set up between those businesses. While we certainly sympathize with a particular intention and we have wish nothing but the best for Lanes Bureau, due to the unintended consequences, we feel that perhaps a better option would be to provide some relief maybe on the income tax side. I did also want to mention that on the two-night minimum stay, when the original 4C language was being talked about, that was actually a compromise. The resort people were looking for a longer term. I believe they were looking for 5 days, and they did agree to accept 2 days. So even going down to 2 days was a compromise, and to eliminate that altogether for this particular case would really be a dramatic change. So thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Heidelberger.
Correct.
Yes. And Representative Poppy, final words for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppy, we have one more person that would like to testify.
My name is Colleen Lehman, and I am representing a property in Moore, Minnesota, as well as in Waynesboro. I also do work, have a position with the Chamber of Commerce and work at, have been working on this law since the year 2004. I appreciate the assessor's comments. I do want to throw in a couple of things. We work very closely with the Fillmore County Assessor's Office as well as Maui County Assessor's Office. And I will tell you a quote from him last year at this time, when we were discussing this law, and it was, he said, this change in language would make all of our lives a lot easier. Because as the assessor from Alexandria reported, this law was written for northern Minnesota. And in southern Minnesota, we don't have big lakes. We don't have the same type of things. This was written clearly for Northern Minnesota. However, what has happened is that we are fitting in to this classification as small mom-and-pop hotels. And there is no change, there's no shift in taxes, because the fact of the matter is, since 2004, our properties are doing it. What we're trying to do here is to allow for our guests to be able to come and stay with us for periods that they want to stay with us, and not have to sell fishing lures and things like that in our businesses to fit into this property tax classification. So the property tax does not shift. It's already done. And while we would agree that we know it was written for Northern Minnesota, what about, we are the resorts of Northern Minnesota in Southern Minnesota. We don't have big resorts. We have mom and pop owned, run businesses, and we don't have franchises. So when we speak to the hotel and motel at large, if there was a Motel 6 that went and put themselves on a community that was 2,500 or less, it's probably not going to be too likely that they're only going to stay open for 250 days out of the year. Typically, franchise businesses are not going to do that. So please take into consideration this new language for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Lehman. Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I am somewhat confused as to why the assessors think they have a dog in this show here. I think that this committee and the tax committee needs to do what they did last year and pass this through, and the assessors should do what this legislature says they should do.
Representative Poppy, you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I just wanted to state something that Mr. Lehman and Ms. Lehman also has talked about. This bill talks about lodging. It doesn't talk about resorts, you know, per se. It talks about lodging, and that's what we're talking about, is lodging. And it is in Southern Minnesota that it's different. Certainly, I don't represent Lanesboro. That's why Representative Davids is here. He represents that city. I do represent Leroy. Leroy is a very quaint, wonderful little community, but it is the Suites Hotel that people can go to that is a marvelous little location. But frankly, in Southern Minnesota, small communities may not be a destination point unless there's a reason to go, and going to the Suites Hotel might be that destination reason. And so really what we're looking at is hoping to extend the classification, allowing our communities to be able to sustain businesses that have chosen to be created within our small rural communities. So we would ask for your support. We would ask for the inclusion. And as Representative Davids has stated, this has met with your approval in the past, and we would seek that approval again. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. And I'll lay over House File 3737 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Representative Lancheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. It's really not on this bill per se, and we have passed it through before. And I was just looking for the Minnesota Tax Handbook and asked Charlie to see if he could go get one, and Assistant Commissioner Cadoon passed me hers. But before I had a chance to open it, I was wondering if you would permit me to ask Mr. Hines, just thinking about the classification rates and the property tax system, I wanted Mr. Hines, maybe if he could, or I'm not sure who to for sure direct the question to, really, how many classification rates do we have in Minnesota? Some states have one, and a lot of states have two or three. I think Minnesota has quite a few, but I'm just kind of curious for perspective here now when we're discussing just this bill.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lancheski, it isn't necessarily so much the number of rates. We really have kind of got it down to where we have, you know, 1%, 1.25%, 2%. We don't really have too many different rates, but we have lots of different combinations of criteria to get you into rates, where the tiers occur, and which state tax you may or may not fall into. So there's lots of different, and it isn't even really possible to state a number. It kind of depends on how much detail you want to get into. But I was just trying to make out during the hearing the different kinds of similar property situations we have here, just trying to go through the law. And we have a separate situation for homestead resorts that are not homestead, bread and breakfasts, seasonal restaurants on a lake, marinas, VFWs that don't generate revenue have kind of come into the seasonal rec classification, golf courses. They're all kind of have class rates around 1%, 1.25%. Some have tier splits at 500, and most qualify for the seasonal recreational state rate. So there's lots of somewhat similar but not the same classes in this milieu of types of property.
And Mr. Chair, and if I may, and
Representative Lachowski.
And I should have asked it that way. I'm just trying to make the point here. I think that was one subset of the property tax code. And if you did that with the commercial industrial homes, farms, house and a 1 acre and a garage, you know, I mean, I have supported this bill. I just think we have gotten so far afield in the property tax system. We have states that have one, and everyone pays the exact same thing. And maybe that's an interim project. Maybe that's an interim project because it's really, I think it's got to be 30 plus different. Different 30, 40, 50, and some states have one. So, I think Representative Marquardt has supported this bill in the past, and I have, and I think they're on to something here. But it's getting mind-boggling. Keep it up.
Thank you, Representative Lachowski. Representative Davis.
This is a very, very important discussion. I think we haven't even brought out the fact of what the difference is in property taxes for their facilities. Mm-hmm. If they go in here or if they don't, it's a matter of keeping open or shutting the doors.
Right.
And I think it's pure insanity that we would not approve this so that they can stay open. That's what it comes down to. If we don't get them in the proper classification, they very well may be shutting their doors. I think that's just wrong.
Thank you, Representative Poppy, Representative Davis. I renew my motion to lay over House File 3737 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Report.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is great.
Okay, next.
I would say to the floor because we have not, say we have not, see, I pay some debts, we have to stay up right in sight. I mean, since then, well, I was, I'm going
to. Representative Davis, that's the first time I've heard the insanity plea before this day. Representative Tilbury, thank you so much for chairing. Appreciate that. We are now to House File 2617. Representative Skelzies, do we have a motion to? Representative Dietrich moves to lay over House File 2617 for possible inclusion into the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, House File 2617, was brought to me by a constituent. It was focused on housing improvement areas, which you probably know as committee members, as a way for, say, a condominium association or someone of that, a group of housing of that nature would be able to do a project, much like single-family residential would do a street project or a sewer project or a water project, whereby the city would sell the bonds and then the property owners would be assessed and they could pay the assessment on their taxes. And the housing improvement area law has been a really good law for a city like Little Canada, who has a large percentage of their housing units in multiple buildings. And high cost repairs may be needed, and this gives them that tool. And this idea came to me from Don Valento, who's a former state representative. He was the mayor of Little Canada. He was a state representative here for my area. And he also was a retired contractor, and he noticed that there might be a problem in his building where he owned a condominium unit. So, and he had the background and he knew how to correct the situation, and we have the HIA law, which is a wonderful tool. The process was a long one, and I think it took a little longer than it should have, mainly because a small percentage has the ability to veto the project. And what happened in this particular building would be explained better by the residents, and I have a couple of them here. Unfortunately, Mr. Valento is out of town, so, but I put in your packets a letter from him so that you can understand where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. Testifying today on his behalf is Marge Beauvais. She's the president of the Canterbury Square Condominium Association. We also have with us Laura Stone Giraj, the vice president of the association, and Joel Hansen, the city administrator of Little Canada. And so I'll turn it over to Joel Hansen first.
Mr. Hansen, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joel Hansen, the city administrator for the city of Little Canada. We believe the HIA tool is a wonderful program that enables us to help associations maintain housing stock in our community. As Representative Scalzi indicated, we have a lot of our housing in multiple family structures. We've witnessed associations where they have not done a good job of maintaining their internal fees and are now faced with some large deferred maintenance expenses that cannot be addressed simply by one-year assessments, which many of their bylaws seem to only allow. Last year, we had three projects come through the city, resulting in $5.8 million of improvements. Canterbury Square is the largest. It impacted over 450 housing units in the city. And we're seeking two changes to this. This is from our experience in having gone through this process now, really four times, three that went ahead. The first is a petition requirement. Right now, an HIA can be initiated by receiving a petition from 25% of the owners of any association. And that's how these projects all proceeded, and they went fine. But what we learned was that percentage should probably be higher. We think that percentage at 50% would make more sense because it would ensure that the association has done their homework to enlist that much support on the front end of a project versus 25% and then facing a veto from a much smaller percentage. We've experienced that these projects, there's a lot of due diligence involved, a lot of research, typically professional consultants involved in helping, coming up with plans and specifications for the type of work that needs to be done. People want to know what work specifically will be done and how much will it cost. And if a project doesn't have strong support in the front end, that process can break down in the interim, and that's what happened in Canterbury Square, and resulting in a lot of extra costs being expended. The other provision is changing the veto requirements. Again, if 50% now could initiate an HIA versus 25%, currently 35%, and it's not of the owners, it's of property tax capacity, can veto it. That tracks fairly close to ownership, at least in the situations we were encountering. But when a third of the units can stop a project, and in the case of what you hear from Canterbury Square, which would have been devastating to them, that seems like that's a little less than democratic to have that few of a percentage do that. We understand not being onerous and requiring too high a percentage so that the minority can be trampled over in these processes, but we think an increase in that percentage to the 45 level proposed in this legislation would make sense.
All right. Thank you. And next.
My name is Marge Beauvais, and I'm the president of the board for Canterbury Square. I've been an owner of Canterbury since 1980. I've owned for 30 years. It's my home, and I love it. It's a great place to live, and I have wonderful neighbors. When I first moved into Canterbury 30 years ago, it was the place to be. I've watched it over the years deteriorate until we had a situation where 2 years ago, when we brought in an engineer to give us some advice about water intrusion, he said at any point in time, we could have a catastrophic situation where we have something, a wall giveaway. In fact, as they've been doing this project, when they stripped away some of the stucco, we saw cinder blocks that look like cottage, like Swiss cheese. They had eaten away that much. We had a great deal of deterioration, mold, et cetera, et cetera. We were vetoed once by a small number of people. We went for a second round. We went for a larger project, and we had to work very hard. I would say this project, the HIA, has been a wonderful tool for us. We would not have been able to do what we needed to do, and we needed to do it, or else we would all be out on the street in a year or two. I think the percentage of getting into the project and the veto are absolutely too low. Our people are used to 50% carries the vote one way or another. We were vetoed that first time with a very small margin. Most of the people in the building wanted this project to go, and it didn't go. It has cost us 6 months and over $100,000. And for some of our people, many like myself who are retired, that's a hefty amount of money that didn't need to be spent. We did retesting on things that we had done 2 years previous, we had to pay a penalty for starting work late, $89,000 for the construction company. That's $89 down the tubes. This would not have happened if we had had the percentages at a higher rate than what they are. And I can tell you, I'm so grateful that we have this HIA. And that little tweaking will help. Thank you.
Representative Muller, do you have a question now, or do you want to wait until?
Anytime.
Okay, why don't we listen to one more testifier and then questions? Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Laura Stone Geraj. That's J-E-R-A-J. I don't have too much to add here. As a member of the Board of Directors, we have the duty to maintain our building, and we have to maintain our property values. So when we have this small group of people who don't want to spend any money to maintain our building, even though it's obviously very necessary, it puts all the rest of us in a very bad position. And what we finally ended up doing was taking a vote and saying, we will assess you regardless, because as a board, we have the duty to maintain the building. And so we got the owners to vote after we'd had second expert reports saying, you have mold and rot all over your building. You have to take care of it. You need a new roof. Our dues were artificially low for 25 years, and we didn't have the money to fix our building. And so the second round, when we went back to try to get the HIA funding again, we already had our owners vote for the assessment, and we said, well, this is just your secondary source of financing. You know, if you veto HIA, you still have to pay the money. In reality, it would not have worked because we wouldn't have been able to collect enough money. We have a lot of people on fixed incomes. With the HIA, people can defer their assessments until they sell their unit, and we have people with disabilities who couldn't afford it, or people who couldn't get a housing improvement area loan. So this was really the only way we could have done our project. And even the second time, after additional experts came in and said, you really need to do this. Your building, you know, you could have a balcony fall off or whatever. We still had over 30% ready to veto. And we came very close to having it vetoed again. And so I ask that you strongly consider raising that veto level to at least 45%. And the 50% to start the project will really help associations get organized and get their membership behind it from the front end. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mowry?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I don't see anybody from MCIOA section. The Bar Association is here. Normally, anything involving condos and rights of condo owners, we always find out where that section of the Bar Association is something. So if this is going to go any further, I think that we need to check with Dave Ide. I believe he's still chair of that section, or Walter Graff, or somebody from Ide's office, to see where they stand on it. And I see Representative Druskowski there, who's the lead Republican on my committee. We'll have to also discuss it with him whether normally anything regarding condos and affecting rights and percentages have to go to our committee, and so we'll have to talk about that too. Okay.
Very good. Thank you. I have a question. So to do an action, it's 50% the proposal of housing units, but to veto, it'd be 45% of tax capacity, of the amount of tax capacity. Is that correct? So you actually have two different, you're dealing with two different bases there. One's on units and one's on tax base, basically. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that based on the current statute, that's how it's written. Mm-hmm. It would probably not be a bad idea to change the tax capacity percentage to ownership from a simplicity standpoint, because it really confuses people when you're trying to explain that at these various hearings, but yeah. I didn't want to challenge the wisdom of the initial draft.
I just like to mention...
Ms. Bova, yeah.
Yes, it's really three, because for our owners, I mean, this was not a language we understood. And but we do understand we each own a certain amount of land, and we have a certain amount of percentage. So if we have 236 units in our building, the percentage of ownership adds up to one. I own 0.0042% of the common property in the building. That's how everything that we do is done. So our association fee is based on that. Everything that we do is done on that. And so when we have a vote, we all understand that we need 50.01% of us voting on something. And so this was so very confusing for our people.
Okay. Is there any other comments from anyone in the audience, for or against, that would like to testify? Mm-hmm. Representative Skelzy, any closing comments on this?
Well, I would just like to say thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for your time. This bill was introduced on January 7th, so it's been out there quite a while. If any other committee wanted to hear it or there was any concerns by anyone. So, and I'm just thankful that you gave us a hearing today, and this is a good law. The HIA law has been a godsend to buildings like this that had extensive mold damage, and otherwise they would have lost their whole investment. It was very close to that. And so it's been a wonderful thing, and they're just hoping, as Don Valento has mentioned, that people in the future wouldn't have to go through the problems they went through in the time lag, so people in the future would be able to take care of the problem more quickly. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and thank you for your testimony. And Representative Dietrich renews her motion to lay over House File 2617 for possible inclusion into the division report. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for the wait. We are now going to move to Representative Beard, House File 3548. And do we have someone that would like to move that?
I'll move House File 3548.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Lanning moves House File 3548 for possible inclusion. And we also do have the DE1 amendment.
I'll move the DE1 amendment as well.
Representative Lanning moves the DE1 amendment. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail and the amendment is adopted. Thank you very much. We now have it, which how you want it. Representative Beard, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's good to be in front of this committee. I have never been here before in 8 years.
It's a treat, sir.
It seems like a simple little bill compared to the stuff I just listened to. This is pretty amazing.
Next bill on the agenda. There's no goodies or anything.
Mr. Chairman, there's no treats.
First time.
Representative Beard, please proceed cautiously.
Freshman gap on my part. Members, this is a bill that deals with policy. The policy surrounding the airport fund and the Department of Aeronautics at the Department of Transportation. Having served 8 years on the Transportation Committee, I'm pretty conversant with that division of DOT, particularly since I have some interest in things aeronautical and so on. Since we first took the $15 million back in 2003 from that fund, I've been paying a lot of attention to it. And this bill is one of a series of bills that are making their way through the House in various stages, probably not many of them passing this year, but at least we got the discussion started. And this is one we need to have discussion about. And that's how we certify the airline flight property tax, which technically is a property tax, members. Since 1945, we have been in lieu of taxing the daylights out of things in a complicated procedure, have a very clear-cut and simple procedure on how we tax airlines in this state. It's my estimation that in a few recent years, the Department of Aeronautics has not been complying with the statute as it's written, I believe in Section 370 that you have before you, 270. And so I'm proposing a few policy tweaks that will add some clarification, some transparency, and some accountability. Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to introduce my witness, who will talk a little bit about the history of how we got to where we're at, and I think might shed a little more light, might help you with your questions and your thinking about this proposed bill.
Thank you very much. Please state your name and please proceed.
My name is Ray Strege, S-T-R-E-G-E, and I believe there's a handout available on this.
Please proceed. That'll be passed out. So please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's four components to the State Airports Fund at the present time. Revenue sources, that's the air flight property tax, the aviation fuel tax, the aircraft registration, and interest on the fund. We're here today talking about the air flight property tax portion of this. When the fund was initially created in 1945, the air flight property tax was based upon the average statewide tax rate. In 1982 through 1987, the amount of the flight property tax increased by 60%. So the legislature attempted to give some relief to the airlines. In 1988, flight property tax being based upon a statewide rate, it was just stated as $7.5 million. In 1989, it went to $7.9 million. And then in 1992, it was changed to the current language, which defines the property tax portion of the State Airports Fund as the difference between the total fund appropriation and the estimated fund revenues from the other sources in this in the fund. And again, those other sources are the aviation fuel tax, aircraft registration, and interest. As Representative Beard mentioned, it appears that during probably at least the last dozen years, this method of assessing the air flight property tax has not taken place, and the swing was, if we look back over that period of time, would have been in both directions. Sometimes the airlines would have paid more and sometimes less. The bill that's in front of us requires that the calculations be shown in the certification. The law requires that the Commissioner of Transportation certify to the Commissioner of Revenue what that amount is. In the handout, the next to the last page shows the most recent certification, and it just simply states that the air flight property tax will be $7.8 million, but it doesn't show any type of how they got to that number. The last page of the handout shows what this would require. It would require that the State Airport Fund appropriation be shown, and then the estimated aircraft registration tax revenue, the estimated aviation fuel tax, and the revenues from the interest, plus any possible other, which hasn't happened yet, sources of revenue be subtracted from that, and the bottom line then becomes the air flight property tax. It's just lending some transparency to compliance with the law. And then on the backside, there is also, to make this a little easier to understand, the back side of the bill talks about some dates, moving it the current date for certification from September 1st to December 31st, and then the notification of the airlines from to March 1st, and the due date for the for the tax to come into the state as April 1st. What this does is, instead of having only 1 month out of the state fiscal year of actual revenues to base their estimate upon, this would give them 5 months, so the estimate would become somewhat more accurate. So I respectfully recommend that House File 3548 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
I know we have Mr. Nelson from Department of Revenue here. Could you come forward? And
yes.
It's a miss.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Miss
Nelson. And if I'm, what happens here is the Office of Aeronautics requests of the Department of Revenue what that property tax levy should be, or how does that work?
Correct.
So they, you know, it's been $7.8 million
for the last 4 years or 5 years at least.
Okay, and so they, and how do they make that calculation exactly again? Or
it's that? Not, I basically, Mr. Chairman and members, it's basically just, they just give me the number.
Okay.
It's that simple. I just call them up, or I actually send an email, and he sends me back an email.
Okay, so that, very good.
And I think as long as it's not changed, then we don't ever consider it, because the law states that if it doesn't, if nothing is given, then there's no change.
Say that again, Ms. Nelson. So, let's see. So it says, if a levy amount has not been certified by September 1st of a levy year, the commissioner shall use the last previous certified amount?
Right, so I think that's the reason why it just stays at the same, because it's not certified anymore. That's just a speculation.
Oh. Interesting. Is there anyone here? Well, thank you, Ms. Nelson, if you might have more questions. Anyone here from the Office of Aeronautics? Okay. Just to get a little more background on this, we could. Please state your name.
My name is Peter Buchan. My last name is spelled B-U-C-H-E-N.
Okay, please proceed.
Actually, this number is the only number I've known my whole career in the Office of
Oh, my goodness.
So I've not been privy to how this has been calculated.
Okay. Now,
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative.
You have my delete all amendment in front of you. If you look on lines 1.10, 1.11, and 1.12,
yeah.
That pretty much tells you, gives direction on how that number is arrived at. The other sources that are referred to in 1.12 are the sources that Mr. Strager referred to. There's basically four funding streams in the department: fuel tax, registration fee, other income, and the flatland property tax. So basically it's A plus B plus C, subtract that from the appropriation.
And Representative Beard, who sets the appropriation?
And Mr. Chairman, that's to be the legislature.
And so
the Transportation Committee, in which I sat.
Okay, and then what has that been the last few years? Do you have it on this column here, the total appropriation?
Actually, there is, yes, there is a column here that says the total appropriation. Mr. Chairman, this has been part of the issue that we've had is in the years, even predating my election to this place, the Department of Aeronautics has been buried in the Department of Transportation between four and six levels down, and usually gets an expenditure, and this is where Ms. Baker, I'm going to ask you for some direction on what the terms mean. I call it their budget, their authorization for their work plan. Somehow it's called an appropriation, I believe, because these monies actually technically come from the general fund, even though they're special accounts. These monies are user fees that are collected specifically for the purpose of funding the expenditures you see on this sheet here. No other general fund money comes, it's just this stuff. The number has been kind of a mystery to us on the Transportation Committee. There just is a number there. The flatland property tax has been certified at 7.8. Sometimes the balance builds, as you'll notice the column all the way to the right. Sometimes the balance gets very high, sometimes not so much. And Mr. Chairman, I suppose I can give you a little more of the history that I may be helpful to the background here. whenever the golden age of aviation was dawning upon us back in the 40s and 50s, everyone was paying all kinds of taxes into funds, and it became apparent to the people in the legislature that there needed to be a Department of Aeronautics to help guide this industry as it grew and connected Minnesota to the rest of the world. And so the Department of Aeronautics was formed. It became apparent quickly also that we wanted the hometown guys, be it North Central or Northwest Orient, to be able to be based here. And so we could not tax them like we tax regular folks like me and Representative Dill, who buy airplanes and use them in the course of our business in this state. So we gave the airlines a pass. They pay no sales tax on their equipment. They pay no registration fees, and I think you've heard me mention on the floor before, our registration fees are the most onerous in the nation. The airlines got a pass on registration fees, no sales tax, and they pay a half a cent a gallon on their fuel. The rest of us pay a nickel a gallon and pay registration and sales tax. In exchange for that, an agreement was reached with the legislature many years ago, and I'm not sure if it was in 1945 or 1953, that the airlines would pay what was known as the flight line property tax. And this is how we arrived at this computation that we're trying to understand here today. They would pay a property tax in lieu of all other taxes that would be set by the Department of Aeronautics, and the Aeronautics Department would figure out how much it costs to run their division, subtract the other revenue streams that they got from people like Representative Dill and myself, and then they would assess the airlines whatever the balance was. That was the gentleman's agreement, if you'll pardon the expression, that we've worked under for almost 60 years in this state. Until, if you'll notice in the left-hand column on the sheet, it looks like this that you have, until September of 2001, that number used to move around a little bit, and after the terrorist attacks and the airlines got in a big world of hurt, the department unilaterally cut the flight line property tax by $1 million to kind of relieve some of the strain on the airlines. And then again in 2005-2006, when the hometown airline filed for bankruptcy protection, we again cut them a very big deal to kind of help them through the thicket there. You'll notice in 2013 there's a big jump from 7.8 to 12 million. That's part of the bankruptcy agreement. The monies that were abated in 2006 or the paid back in 2015. So the number has moved a little bit over the years. But by and large, that's the history and the understanding that we've all had on how this fund works. But you can see in the last several years, the number has not really been calculated. It's just been dittoed from the year before. And one of the things that we're concerned about is that that balance on the right-hand side then basically has little accountability. If the fund builds and the legislature's in session and we're having a cash flow problem, this becomes bait to be snatched once again, which is one of the reasons that we're asking you to move the certification and the due date from January 1st until April 1st. Not only will it give the commissioner the November forecast to work with and several more months of history from the previous year, it also means the airlines don't have to pay us a whole bunch of money until the legislature is almost out of session. I'm sorry to give away my trade secrets, but this is one of the things we're trying to accomplish, is that it lets the airlines hang on to the money a little longer and hopefully keeps it in the aviation system for contractors that build airports pay runways.
Appreciate it. All right. So now, who can tell me how much the property taxes will go up on the airline flight property tax? Who can tell me that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, under this scenario,
Representative,
they'll either go up nor down. They'll just be reported in a timely fashion according to this the due dates that are reported here. They might go up, they might go down. We won't know that until we do a budget on the cash flows that are coming in and what the program of work is.
Representative Beard, but line 1.14 to 1.17, doesn't that kind of reverse the process? What's saying is that what's ever appropriated and then what doesn't come in is now left up to the property taxes. And I was thinking that would go up. Sure. Because rather than having a kind of a set amount, now it's part of a calculation.
It's always been that way.
It's been that way.
Okay. Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Strait.
Lines 1.10 to 1.12 are neither underlined nor struck through, so that stays the same, and that is the
definition of the property tax.
Mr. Chairman, basically what this bill does is ask the, actually ask is a kind word, the Commissioner of Transportation to actually do the math and then show the chairs of the committees and the ranking minority members how he did the math, where the numbers came from. And if they decline to do that, the members get notified as well. So in summation, you asked for what does this do to make government a little better?
Representative Beard.
Sure.
I'm still confused here, which can happen easily. But on this here, what's the total appropriation on this chart that you gave? Which one's the total appropriations?
That the legislature authorizes to expend?
Yes, I suppose which one, that's...
Perhaps Mr. Buchan can best it, because he's the one that spends the money we
offer. All right, Mr. Buchan, can you...
The actual appropriation doesn't appear on this sheet. It's a tallying, as I interpret this sheet, it's a tallying of what we have expended in the year to date and an estimate into the future of what it will be. And it is showing the balance in the state airports fund in the far right column. And it is also a tallying to date of what the revenues were from the four sources that are listed.
Okay, which column shows the amount of the four revenue sources?
Total.
I don't see any of them adding up
total.
Properly.
The total.
The column that says total.
Total.
Okay. No, all right, the total. But I go back to 2008 and it's $35 million. And the four numbers only add up to.
Oh, you're right.
Like $19 million. That's,
we're missing a $15 million number.
Yeah.
Remember when we
brought
this money the first time? It was to be put back on July 1st of 2007, and it never was. So whenever we got down to the crisis of 2 years ago, and the Senate actually had a hearing on this, they said, we just put $15 million, let's go get it, and the aeronautics guy said, no, you never put it back. And so they had to quickly slip it in and back out. So if you pull that $15 million out of there, that means we're down to about 20. That's roughly the number you're looking at there. That's why that took a big jump.
All right.
Which is part of why I've gone to all this pain and aggravation to ask you to make people be a little more accountable and transparent to the committees that are responsible for their budgets.
Thank you. Is there anyone who, Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just baffled as to why we even bother to call this a property tax, since it doesn't go to the local jurisdictions and it's calculated in a pretty odd way. And I'm not sure that it has kind of an appropriate sort of level of review, even though I like the word transparency. I mean, I just look at, the aircraft registration fees, nothing's changed. Is projected to change going forward. There's revenues that have bounced around. It just feels like there needs to be more ownership of this moving forward. But to say that the airline flight property taxes would stay at the same level going forward into the next 4 years, I mean, there's a lot of property owners in this state who would love to have that commitment. And so I'm still wrestling with why... Not only why do we have this system, but are we really fixing it in a way that's fair to the community served by this and the other public resources that are influenced here? And maybe that's just more of a statement than not, but it does seem to me to have a flat sort of assessment doesn't really respect the fact that inflation, unfortunately, hits most of us, and there's projections it's going to go up in the future, and... to maybe look at something more dynamic.
Yeah, I'm going to open up to anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against. Please come forward. So, and thank you so much, testifiers. Please state your name and.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Davidman. I represent Delta Airlines as well as the Air Transport Association, which is the National Trade Association of basically all the airlines that serve the state of Minnesota. You know, our concern with the bill, I agree with what Representative Beard is trying to get at as far as clarity, and as it's been alluded to a few times in the committee today. Yeah, our concern of the bill was brought up when we saw the property tax, the note. And it says that in the out years, the airline flight property tax was going to go up about $1.85 million. And, it, you know, or roughly $2 million. And President Beard did an outstanding job of giving an outline of the fund. Just to give you some other background on it, under the current fund, airlines pay about 55% of what goes into the fund. GA pays about 40%, and there's about 5% of investment income. The money then goes out into the 129 airports outside of the MAC system. Some of the money, a small portion, goes to the reliever airports, but none of the money goes to MSP. So if you think 97% of the airlines' flights in Minnesota go out of MSP, whether it's Delta, Southwest, Sun Country, you name it, none of that money goes back to MSP. We pay rates and charges. We pay our CIP there as well. The money does go to some airports that we serve. Out of the 129 airlines fly to, I believe outside of MSP, about 7 or 8 currently. The rest of the money, so about a third of the money goes to those airports, and about two-thirds of the money that gets expended goes to airports that the airlines aren't currently serving. I'm not saying that's right. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just giving the background. We pay, you know, we feel a fair share of what the current fund is. As I spoke to Representative Beard about, we agree that more clarity, more matching up to what the need is, makes a lot of sense. This language has confused us, and we talked about it a little bit, and then when I saw the property tax note, and we saw an increase, that's about a 20% increase to all airlines on what they're currently paying in their property tax going forward. And so that's what brings us as far as we're concerned today.
Thank you. Well, you know, I think that gets to the point again where it's been a set amount of $7.8 million, but this seems to either clarify it or whatever, that the levy amount's going to be the difference between the appropriation and the other revenue sources that come in.
Yeah.
And that would lead to the increase, potentially. Is that what would...
Did you... Representative Lucheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right. I'm just trying to understand it, too, so... Just a concern I have on the construction here, is there sort of whatever you want to spend then, you'll just be guaranteed you're going to get it? Is that how the, I mean, there's no sort of accountability to have some limit that would force people to not want more? You know, when, because these folks aren't going to stand for election or anything. So am I misunderstanding the structure here that, you know, you say what you need, you minus out what your revenue thing is, and whatever is left remaining, you're guaranteed to get it? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe I have it completely wrong. I'm just trying to understand. Maybe Representative Beard could clarify.
Yep. Representative Beard, you could clarify that question. We're going to have Mr. Ouellette come up here and talk about this potential property tax increase and what it is.
Okay.
But Mr. Representative Beard, if you want to...
Sure, just an observation. I have yet to see a fiscal note on this because there was no tax implications. It's a policy change is what it is. Yeah, but I know that in the Senate somehow I think there was one floating around. But to Representative Lucheski's question, for 60-some years, yes, this is the way it's worked. It takes so much to run the Department of Aeronautics. And if there are major construction projects, because it's a federal system, the Department of Aeronautics is the state representative for the FAA. Most of those funds for Duluth Airport, Wyndham Airport, Luverne, wherever we're at, most of those construction funds come from an FAA appropriation, which also runs through the Department of Aeronautics. I don't, Mr. Buchan, I think $90 million-ish a year is a ballpark number over the last handful of years. Peter Wynn, here we go.
Approximately
70. Come again?
70 million.
Okay, 70, 80. It depends on how much FAA money is flowing through the aeronautics department. That money all comes through, too, which is completely untouched by this. But just to run the department, the nav aids, the maintenance funds that they hand out, and the other things that the department does, and I don't want to turn this into a transportation committee hearing, but that has been running historically around $17, $18 million a year, and has for some time. So it's always been a number that will be in a range over the years of running from, I'll just hear, $8 million, $8 million, $7, $3, $8, $7, $7, $7, $8, so on and so forth. and it's always been an understanding that, yes, it goes up, yes, it goes down. So I guess my question to the committee would be, and it's hypothetical, theoretical, rhetorical. Whenever we cut the fund in 2001, or when it was cut again in 2006, is that a tax cut? And then if it went up the next year, is that a tax increase? Technically, I suppose, yes, it is. Yeah. Is this a moving target? The parameters and the construction of which is described in lines 110, 111, and 112 in the statutes that you have in front of you? Yes, it is. So can you say this is a tax increase? I suppose you could. Could you say it's a tax cut? Sure, you do that too.
Representative Lincheski.
Well, I guess I'm not really trying to get to that because to me it is a tax increase or cut, depending on what's going on, since it's in levy form, but on in-flight property. But where's the... I'm not understanding how this works. Where is the accountability for the spending request? Okay, so I guess if I'm understanding it correctly, it's the Transportation Committee in the House and Senate who say, we're going to spend X amount in this, and so then the calculation happens, which is not overseen by a tax committee. It just gets an automatic, almost like a dedicated tax without scrutiny other than in the Transportation Committees. Is that a fair assessment or not?
Representative Beard?
That is a very fair assessment. When MnDOT brings their humongous bill, there are two or three pages dedicated to the Aeronautics Division, which has in there their program of work in the broadest possible terms, and unless the individual representatives, such as myself, take the time to actually query the aeronautics people about what exactly are you spending this money on, it's buried in a number that is relatively similar from year to year, and so that's where the oversight is. It's there. Part of why I'm trying to do this is to bring a little more accountability and transparency, a very small amount, mind you, but is to bring some apparent transparency and accountability so that somebody has to notify the chairs of the committee and the ranking minority members of what the number is, or if the commissioner is neglecting to actually specify the number and the fund balances, we're made aware of that also. So yes, it happens a lot on autopilot, no pun intended, and it's just out there, and for years and years it's kind of run that way, and I'm asking that we change the policy so there's just a small, modest amount of increased accountability to people with election certificates.
Representative.
Okay, and I'm sorry to ask, but I'm trying to understand it, and I actually sat on this airport tax commission with everybody,
it was a long, hot summer.
I think the amendment is an improvement to the bill. I guess I would just offer that I think having the same report going not just to the chairs of transportation but to the chairs of taxes and the commissioner of revenue would be a healthy addition to the discussion. But if I may just ask Mr. Michael, I think to, you know, give all of us in the room a little clarity as to what's going on here, and I also want to ask it in light of Mr. Davidman's testimony. You know, I do know that the big carrier, you know, that are Delta and others, you know, they have concerns with any taxes. I also know they're exempt from lots of taxes, and in fact, I guess I'd like to ask if the sort of all the tax preferences were provided for headquartered air or aviation. Have we repealed any of those sort of, I guess, golden boy provisions that all the, when the headquarters was here, there was a lot of stuff there to make that be so. And I think folks know that I tried to you know, raise the CI tax as a property levy on the MSP, you know, feeling that was something that, since if we're going to lose headquarters, they should start chipping in a little more. But I'm trying to understand all of this together in a way that, you know, makes sense to just to maybe me. Maybe I'm a slow learner here, but it seems like it's confusing a lot of members as I look around at other people's faces. So maybe Mr. Michael can help us a little bit.
Mr. Michael, could you give us a 10,000-foot view of things? No pun intended.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think Representative Beard did a good job of explaining the differential rates, for example, on the aviation fuel and the registration tax, which, you know, it's sort of an unusual structure where it's, you know, normally tax rates go up as the amount goes up, like the income tax, but this is the reverse, and that's intended to favor the scheduled carriers that use a lot of aviation fuel and make them sort of more competitive. And as the chair mentioned, the property taxes at MSP, because of the way the law is written, they don't pay either a city tax or a school tax. So all they pay is the Hennepin County tax and then whatever MAC assesses them. And so depending upon how you view that, that could be a considered to be favorable or not. I guess I don't have anything to say about this process, which seems like it, it sounds like the process that they've been following here is not exactly what the law exactly says, but sort of more of a fixed levy kind of a thing rather than a standard property tax levy, the way we think of it.
Thank you. Mr. Ouellette, Department of Revenue, how do we come to this $1.85 million property tax increase?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Eric Ouellette with the Department of Revenue, and I'll do my best, but we relied on the aeronautics information from the aeronautics division to come up with this number. Let me first state that the revenue estimate that's before you is based on the language that was introduced, not the Delete Everything Amendment that we've only recently received, so we will need to circle back with aeronautics on that. My understanding of the numbers that we got was that without legislation, it was expected that the levy would continue to be the look back at last year and keep it flat, but that because, as introduced, the language is being stripped out that authorized that look back, they would be forced to go through the calculation and give us this higher levy, which is how you end up with that increase in the projection. Now, the Delete Everything Amendment does reinstate that potential look back, so that's why we need to talk with the Department of Transportation about whether indeed they would exercise that and force the Commissioner of Revenue to report to the legislature that there was no certification and the levy would remain the same as it was in the previous year. I don't know what the answer to that is now, so it may very well be the Delete Everything Amendment would have no levy impact compared to current law.
All right, so we would have to look at that further. So very good. Well, we're going to, anyone else from the audience? I appreciate all the testifiers participating. Representative Beard, any closing comments here?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm glad for the explanation of how they got to this, because I'm certainly baffled as to how they could look at it and come up with 1.8. I know some things that are in the offing in the industry, and if my amendment or this bill was to pass, I think the airlines would probably get a nice pleasant surprise next year because of some major purchases that are pending. They're going to drive revenues from those other sources up substantially next year. However, if it doesn't, then I will prevail upon the commissioner to once again assess them what he's always assessed them, and we'll have even more money in the airport fund. Of course, I say that tongue in cheek, Mr. Chairman. But whenever you offered me a chance to hear, you asked for, you gave me five things that this bill does. Does your bill do any of these five things? And Mr. Chairman, I think point number two, slightly improves accountability, value, or efficiency, and that's what I'm hoping for, as Representative Chesky mentioned. It is a complicated system, and I want people with election certificates to be more engaged, getting notifications, certifications being made, the levies being assessed. Certainly we'll get that. Point number five, it redesigns, although slightly, the structure of process that will make it a function or is originally intended 60-some years ago. The last several years, I don't believe aeronautics has been complying with the law as written. This is a modest attempt to encourage them to do so, and if they don't, we once again, thanks to Ms. Baker's encouragement last night, we gave them the out that they can just do what they did before, but at least elected officials will know promptly that they're playing that way, and then we can use our forum to complain about it or call them to account. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the good discussion surrounding this bill, and we'll see if we can do some good work with it.
Representative Beard, thank you so much for your first appearance here, and very impressive. Thank you. Representative Dietrich renews her motion to lay over House File 3548 as amended for possible inclusion in the revision report. Thank you so much. We will move next to House File 2887, Representative Drazkowski.
Is that all right?
Okay.
This has nothing to do with this bill.
Just Representative Drazkowski, do we have someone that removed that bill? Representative Dietrich moves House File 2887, a possible inclusion in the division report. And we have an amendment. We have the A1 amendment. Representative Dietrich moves the A1 amendment to get the bill into proper form. Any discussion on that? Not, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Representative Druskowski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Mr. Chair, I've learned a little bit about aviation tax.
You do.
Members, if you'll remember back to last year, April of last year, the largest employer in the city of St. Charles burned to the ground, North Star Foods. St. Charles is the largest city in my district, 3,600 people. It's also the largest, North Star Foods was the largest employer in the northern half of Winona County, and if you dissect it the other way, the western half of Winona County as well. We had last session two different efforts to provide some relief to the city of St. Charles. One was to provide some declining pupil aid assistance to the school. The other was an effort or a bill that would have provided some local government aid type of aid to their city to offset some of the losses experienced from the utility payments that were no longer coming from North Star Foods that were substantial because they have municipal utilities there, the property tax, water and sewer, etc. As of last year, they were estimating those to be about $400,000 per year. Now they have some actual numbers and they're coming in just a hair under $300,000 per year that they are the city of St. Charles is not realizing because of the loss of North Star Foods. The bill before you, actually what it does, we've learned since the bill was passed last year for the declining pupil aid, we have learned that it's pretty obvious that they're not going to use all of the authorized credit, if you will, from the state or declining pupil aid. Actually, the bill was written, the declining pupil aid bill was part of the bonding bill last year. It was written, I think, in a very responsible way in that it said that the school would use up to a certain amount and they would come forward and prove that they lost that many students due to the fire. At this point, the best information I have was about a month old, and the estimate that at that point from the superintendent was that there were four students that were lost at 5,000 something per head. So it's a significant portion at this point. Looks like it's not going to be used for this year. This bill actually strikes out, repeals last year's law on page 2 of the bill, 2.6 and 7. And replaces it with language that allows any unused portion of the appropriations that were approved last year to be used and directed then to the city for local aid for the city to help, as I mentioned, offset their losses. There should be members. We've been to two different committees so far, and actually the mayor, the city administrator, and the economic development staff from the city of St. Charles was there for both. They were there for each of those hearings. In lieu of that, there should be in your packet a letter from the mayor and a couple of newspaper articles that outline the situation, within the city and kind of really show you what they're looking to do. They are working right now on developing stronger economic capacity in their city by developing a business park about just under a mile south of St. Charles along I-90, and they would see or plan to use these dollars, if approved by the legislature, to provide some help in developing that business park so that they can restore their economic capacity and bring jobs back to the city of St. Charles.
Okay. Any questions from members?
Anyone from the audience right now that would like to testify for or against House File 2887? Just asking staff, has this occurred before? Anyone remember a situation? I know this is an education, so we might not have ever seen something like this before, but can you think of where dollars have been authorized, you know, for something like declining pupil enrollment or something else that didn't materialize and that money was then used for another purpose by the same entity?
Yeah, I don't think, Mr. Chair, I don't think any of us can think of a very comparable situation, at least on a small scale for a unit of government, maybe at some larger scale of appropriation or something, but nothing comes to mind immediately.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. I would just mention that there is a rather strong precedence in the legislature for helping these local units of government in these types of emergencies. I can't remember the latest fire in southern Minnesota was Austin or Albert Lee within the last decade. St. Peter in a tornado, Hugo in a tornado. Green Isle last year received some expenditures from the legislature for a fire they had in their town. And I, at one point I did have my hand on a much longer list, an extensive list, but the president of the legislature to provide the help is there, but of course that doesn't answer the specific question, Mr. Chair, that you were looking for.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Dalton, last year in the tax bill, was there some things, if I remember right, we had some provisions for St. Charles.
Mr. Chair, we had a sales tax exemption for St. Charles for rebuilding, which is very typical. Going back to Representative Drazkowski's recent statement, I think, actually, I can clarify. In some ways, this is somewhat similar to what we have done in the past in LGA, where we have taken the general appropriation for LGA and given portions of it specifically to individual cities for specific purposes. We've never crossed jurisdictions before that any of us are aware. We've taken education money and moved it to a city. But we have taken LGA money, general LGA appropriations, and moved it to a specific city for a specific purpose. And I think that's what Representative Drazkowski is referencing.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair. Yes.
I'd also mention that it's common in other budget areas, economic development comes to mind, where they have had earmarks in the past and then found that the use has changed, and so they split appropriations. That's not a common thing that I've witnessed here in this committee, but have witnessed in other committees.
Thank you. It's good to get a little historical perspective, and I do strongly agree, of course, Representative Drazkowski, is that the state has always come forward. My district has been benefited greatly from the state legislature during floods and those type of things, so certainly I agree with you there. Anything else? Anything else you would like to add, Representative? So I think we understand the issue, and so I am going to, Representative Dietrich, renews her motion to lay over House File 2887 as amended for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
And now we have Representative Dietrich. She was willing to put her bill's last sacrifice for the team. And we will take House File 2234, Lease Seasonal Recreational Land. And there is an amendment here, too. We have the A1 amendment. Representative Dietrich, you want to first of all move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move House File 2234 for possible inclusion in the property tax division report.
All right. We have that motion. Then you have a DE1 amendment, it looks like.
Yes.
And that you had an A1 amendment, but it looks like you're going to do the DE1 instead.
The DE1 amendment.
All right. Representative Dietrich moves the DE1 amendment so we can put aside the A1 that she has here. Any discussion on the DE1? And then we can talk about that. All those in favor say aye. 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 Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Representative Dietrich, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I just wanted to just make a point now that your bill briefs are not accurate. So if you're looking at the bill brief for details of the bill, you might want to just listen and learn instead. the other thing, just a little side note, I think that I have found the, I think you have discovered the way for me to make sure that nobody asks me to ever carry a bill again. We wait lots of hours. So anyhow, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill exempts property taxation on all land owned by the federal government, which is leased for non-commercial seasonal recreation or non-commercial seasonal recreational residential use. In other words, what it does is it takes federally owned land that is owned by a, I will use the example of a cabin owner. They lease the federally, their land from the federal government, and then they also end up paying property taxes on it as a result of that. And so this exempts those property, those people who lease that the federal property from the property tax. Instead of going through much more rationale about the bill, I have two people here who are experts in the area and have brought the bill forward. They are seasonal recreation owners, and so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to them. First, we'll go to Jeff Forrester, Executive Director of the Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. And I'm just used to calling them cabin owners instead of seasonal recreational. So anyhow, Jeff.
Very good. Mr. Forrester, can someone explain the difference between the DE1 amendment and what we originally had and what was in our bill briefs?
I will do that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The original bill included all government-owned land, city, county, town, and state. And what we are doing is we are narrowing this down to just federally-owned land.
Very good. Mr. Forrester, thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm Executive Director of MSRPO, the Cabin Owners Association. I guess the first point is these are federal use permits. The word lease gets used, but actually they're not leases. They're a permit to locate a cabin on land within the National Forest, but there's a heavy use restrictions put on these, and there's really no ownership of the land. Mr. Kasperson can talk about that, from a personal standpoint. There's some confusion about the amount of money that the federal government returns from these permits to local governments in the state of Minnesota. And this is a very old program, these federal use permits. Back in the late 1890s, when they were talking about creating these national forests, local communities said, well, if you turn this all into national forest, we won't have any tax base left. So the purpose of the national forest was they said, well, we'll manage the land for various uses. We'll manage it for timber, minerals, grazing, and recreation. And actually, one of the first places they wanted to put these federal use permits was in the Boundary Waters. They sent a landscape architect up there to paddle the boundary waters and look for cabin sites, and he came back and said, well, you know, that would be better served as a wilderness area, and they started to locate these federal use permit sites over on Gunflint and in Cass Lake and so forth. 25% of the revenues, originally 25% of the revenues from the National Forest were returned to the state in terms in payments in lieu of taxes. And that's gotten a little bit muddied over the years. The special use permits, logging, mining, grazing, and other fees charged by the National Forest recognize that the loss of tax revenue otherwise received if retained in private ownership. To compensate the affected counties, Congress initiated the 1908 Receipts Payment Act, which returned 25%. Due to declining timber receipts on the National Forest since the 1980s, in 2000, the USDA set out to find new ways to support local communities. The result was the 2008 Secure Rural Lands Act. And I have a table that shows what this fund has been returning to local communities since then. In 2008, nationwide, it was $477 million, with $5,627,942 coming to Minnesota. The other thing that's really an issue here is property tax on these permits. And so I called around to the National Forest in various parts of the country, and learned that really as a straight ad valorem tax, Minnesota's the only one that's handling it this way. These federal use permits can't be sold. I could sell you the building that I have located on the land, but the permit's non-transferable. And it doesn't. There's no conveyance of land that goes with it. So I would be asking you to buy a cabin that you may have to move, because there's no guarantee that the Forest Service will renew the permit for the new person. Some of the comments that I got from Forest Service employees was a Michigan forester said they should not be charging property tax. They ran into this problem on Mackinac Island, but they got it straightened out. Those people cannot even sell the permits. In Texas, U.S. Forest Service lands manager John Eppolito said you cannot charge taxes on federal land. That's what the 25% fund is for. Montana, Florida, and Vermont levy reduced taxes on the structures only. And it's a very small amount of money. And a forester in Vermont characterized taxing the land covered by a federal use permit as ridiculous. A forester in South Dakota said what they are doing is taxing federal property. Tennessee foresters said they can't do that. They were kind of shocked by this question that I had. Gary Schiff, a USDA Forest Service employee in Washington, said, I'm not aware of anywhere they tax the land covered by a federal use permit. The lessees do not own the land. So that's sort of the issue. And then, as you probably know, in 2008, there was kind of this deal where the counties were applying this tax differently, and we had a sort of an unequal application of the law now in Minnesota, where someone in Itasca County would be paying property tax on their federal use permit, and someone in St. Louis County, just not very far away, is paying the tax. So it's sort of a little bit muddied, and I guess that's all I have to say.
Mr. Forester?
Yes.
And, you know, you're talking about other states not, you know, making this exempt from taxation. But, you know, the lease is one thing, but aren't the people on the leased land still benefiting from local services, law enforcement, roads, ditch cleaning, whatever that might be, drainage, education?
Yes.
I mean, there's a service that is being provided. That needs to be
in the way that they all are, you know. I mean, you talk about roads, and in many cases these are national forests, so the road in is not, you know, is a national forest responsibility. And in many cases, and Mr. Casperson can speak to this, it's the people who are there that pay to hire somebody to come in and plow or grade the road or do these things. In most cases, if a tree falls on the cabin, the owner has to get permission to cut the tree and then pay for the removal of the tree. You know, it's different than, you know, my cabin or my land that I have. Yes, certainly I benefit from the local, you know, and I suppose in that way of having an educated population and all that, for, you know, definitely, but it's more removed than even that, you know.
Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to remind members also that the federal government pays 25% of the lease payment to the local county, and so that this bill does not change that. So they do get reimbursed for a certain amount of services, if you will. And I would also like to point out that what the federal government charges for these leases in comparison what to our state, city, counties, lands charge for their leases is, I'll say, substantial. Very healthy, and so when you take 25% of that and that goes back to the local unit of government, that does
pay
for the services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the federal government just a few years ago passed what's known as CUFA, Cabin User Fee Fairness Act, and so for these permit fees, they've been coming in and assessing these properties and charging 5% on their permit fees, and I have some table showing how these fees have changed, but you know, fees that were $900 are now, you know, $3,000, $4,000, and 25% of that money is coming back. So the fees are now getting so high that the 25% is more than the property tax would be if the person owned the land and was paying as any other owner of land would pay, even though, you know, I've heard the property ownership referred to as a bundle of sticks in this committee. And these permit holders are, I mean, maybe holding half a stick, you know. It's, there's not a lot of rights that go with these permits.
Good. I know you have another testifier who's been waiting patiently here. You would introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carl Casperson, C-A-S-P-E-R-S-O-N.
Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My family is has been in possession, if we can put it that way. We have had a cabin in Itasca County in the Chippewa National Forest for the past 35 years. The cabins in our area are not McMansions. They're really rather small, and all of them are under 900 square feet. The property upon which they sit is generally 150 feet square. So you might say, well, gosh, you got a 150-foot lot. That's really pretty nice. It doesn't extend our rights, if you want to put it that way, do not extend all the way down to the lake. There are many regulations and restrictions that are imposed by the Forest Service. For one thing, we had to agree not to occupy these cabins for more than 6 months of the year. Year-round occupation is absolutely out of the question. In terms of something as mundane as the color of the roof or the color that the cabin is painted, are subject to Forest Service regulations. And as Mr. Forrester mentioned, there are no services that are provided. At one time, the Forest Service would come in and they would grade our little 1.25-mile road that served the 12 cabins along the way. But that is no longer the case, and we do contract with one of the local people and then share that expense for ourselves. In terms of educational expense, I would say that the fact that you can't have permanent residency up there sort of speaks for itself. So the cabins on this federal land are really doubly taxed. The CUFA rules was just mentioned by Mr. Forrester, and in fact it's not uncommon. In fact, in our area, the permit fees, we don't call them lease payments or permit fees, are going to go up to close to $4,000 from what they had been, you know, not too many years ago, $700. So it's you can see that there's been a marked escalation in that area. So, you know, we really feel like more and more of us are retired on fixed incomes, and really feel like we're going to be, instead of being able to pass these along to our families, end up being taxed off of this. So we're respectfully requesting that this HF 2234 be included in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Casperson, thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate that. Before I open it up to the audience, Representative Dietrich or Mr. Forrester, could you explain that last sheet here just real quick? I think if I understand this right, this is the 75-25, and is this the 25 portion from the federal government going to the counties? And that last sheet, that I think you mentioned $5.6 million. I think that's...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Forrester.
This last sheet shows... what the local counties received back from the federal government.
On the 75-25?
Well, you know, there's now there's a few different formulas, so there's so they can sort of pick how they would like to get their money and which formula they want to use, whether they want to use the 25% fund or the new program that was implemented a few years ago. Secure Rural, it was 2008, Secure Rural Schools Act. So there's different ways, different formulas that they can pick, and so this is sort of shows which counties are getting what and what the payments have been.
Very good. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I regret I was in another committee when you were dealing with the manufactured homes issue, but I'm wondering if staff might address the question of how we handle manufactured home parks where the land is owned by the, unlike the cooperative, which I think your bill dealt with, mm-hmm. but where you have a private owner who owns the land and is paying taxes on it, but I believe we still recognize and taxes, I think in the old days it used to be personal property, the mobile home that the individual owns and lives on, and, you know, is that a model that would fit here where you have kind of a split ownership?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, clearly in the case of like manufactured homes, you have where the manufactured home is personal property that the person lives in, but they are renting out space for their, I think they call them pads, and that is the owner of that park is paying a real estate tax. In the property tax refund, we do allow them to add, you know, a certain amount of the property tax that's allocated to the manufactured home if they, you know, so they can add those two things together when they file property tax refund. But I think in the case of what we're talking about here for this lease land, these properties are assessed property taxes on the land and the improvements, and this bill does not deal with improvements. This is land only. But they're still subject to property tax, but in addition to that, they are paying lease payments to the federal government for it too. So, you know, I hate to use the term double taxed, but they are paying a lease payment, and then they're paying a property tax, and both of them are being assessed on the person that's using the property. So, you know, I don't think the analogy is a very good one, really, between the manufactured home.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Loeffler
and Ms. Baker, I don't know that it's a perfect fit, but I do think there's sort of a difference here. I mean, when our witness says he would really like to have his family be able to inherit the, you know, access to this cabin that his family has enjoyed for, you know, many decades. I mean, that is a different relationship than when you have, you know, a landlord who could decide, we don't want you anymore, or you don't have any continuity of relationships. And so I'm just trying to figure out if the argument is that the feds are paying the land the land's property taxes, then who should pay the taxes for the value of the improvements, and how should that, what's fair?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, again, a person that has these cabin on this is paying property tax on the improvement as well. So this bill is not in any way affecting the improvement. Improvement is a personal property tax, and that is being left as is. This is only addressing the land. Is that?
All right. Clarifies it if that's the case.
Yeah. All right. Representative Dietrich. And we're going to move here to the audience.
And I just also want to add, it is land owned by the federal government. And well, I'll save the rest of that for another.
Very good. Thank you. Is there someone who'd like to speak for or against this bill? Please state your name and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Andrea Fish. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division.
Very good.
We did have one issue with the language as it was originally introduced last year, and for the sake of fairness, we brought that before the committee. Thank you. And we will just address it based on the current delete everything amendment.
Okay.
We did a survey in 2008 in advance of the 2009 introduction of this language. We surveyed counties as to how many had these federal lands that were leased to individuals for private use. There were 11 counties that responded that they had these lands, only one of which was at the time exempting those lands. So the language that was created in 2008 addressed that one county based on our survey results. And this change would have all 11 counties exempt those federal lease lands. The tax implications of that is a $35 million exemption based on the survey results that we had. And then, of course, that tax burden shifted to other properties in those 10 counties.
So, thank you. So, Ms. Fisher, what you're saying is this bill currently, the language on the delete all amendment would shift about $35 million?
That's value.
No.
Yep, that's the exempted.
That's the value. That's all right. So then you'd have to calculate the taxes after that. Very good. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the woman who just testified, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Ms. Fish.
Ms. Fish, okay, I just want to be clear. So you're just talking on the federal lease lands component was your testimony?
Specifically the federal lease lands. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay. And I think this was Senator Bach and Representative Dill's bill last year, and it was pre- Representative Dietrich just made the change to just the federal component, and when they had the state and the big bill, I thought that was only about, not only. I mean, I'm surprised 35 it's that big, because I had the impression in the testimony when we heard this before that the federal portion of the total value when you combine state and feds was just a little teeny sliver, and I thought the bigger number was about 105. So the federal lease lands are a lot bigger portion of the total lease lands, or whatever you want to call them, permits, than that, right? I always thought it was, I don't know why I have this in my mind looking at Ms. Baker. I thought it was about 7% of the total, when you took state and fed and put them together, I thought fed was 7%. So this looks like it's more like a third. Does that sound right?
Ms. Baker, you remember those numbers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I do agree with Ms. Fish that the federally owned lands are about $35 million, $34.5 million in market value, and then in state-owned, and there's also $27 million of improvements on federal, but that's not an issue because improvements are. State-owned land was very low. That was only $3.7 million, so that was very small. But there were some state-owned tax forfeiture lands, which were $14 million, and then the biggest component was the county and local lands, and that was $65 million. Okay.
So the federal
was a big chunk of the total. And now this is not a county option like the one last time that was passed in 2008. So this would just automatically take that 34.5. And that's a number which was from 2008. And I think the feds have increased that number, I would guess, quite substantially, because they go out every 10 years in value, and I think they just went out in 08 or 09.
Okay.
And that's why these lease payments have gone up so substantially, is because they revalued everything. A lot of this is lake shore, and those numbers have increased. So we don't have that increased number.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Is it possible, thank you, Mr. Chair, to know with any... just thinking about this, in the counties with the, there was a survey of 11 counties. I would guess there's more than 11 counties that have these lands. But do we have any sense of, and I'm sure it would vary county to county, what percentage of the total net tax capacity it is? If Representative Dietrich's bill were to pass, and that burden now shifts off to everyone else in that county, is that a very, is it a drop in the bucket, or any idea on what percentage of net tax capacity is going on there? Because I'll just, be candid here. committee members will recall, we had a big fight about this last time, you know, internally, bipartisanly, you know, sort of when it was everybody, county, state, feds, and that the net effect of the bill that was proposed last time, not Representative Dietrich's, was to shift property tax increases onto everybody else. And I think we were more focused on the county situation, and we couldn't really justify that, and the House rejected that argument. I think the federal argument is more persuasive, in that they've got, you know, they've got this argument they're making on the federal lease lands. But I remember the federal component being so small. And now maybe I'm thinking maybe it was part of net tax capacity, or is it really this big? I just didn't realize it.
Ms. Baker, anything?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, one other point, just so you realize, is this was done from a survey of all the counties, and okay. 59 of the counties responded. So there are some counties that didn't respond, okay. But only 11 of them had federal lands. So when we keep talking about 11 counties, it's because they were the only ones that had federal lands. And I'm sure it was, you know, and I would guess we can get the data for each of those 11 counties, how much is in each of those counties. I don't have that with me because I have kind of a summary here. But it's the counties up north, you know, it's St. Louis and Cass and Itasca and most of those northern counties where this is going to be. And there's 508 parcels that we're talking about here.
Okay.
So.
Anything to add, Ms. Fish?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Baker. Anyone else would care to testify for or against House File 2234?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Borger has a comment that he'd like to make on that information just brought forward.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that number seems surprising to me, considering that there's less than 600 of these federal use permits in the state. And many of them are, you know, as Mr. Kasperson said, none of them are over 1,200 square feet. I mean, they're all small. So you start doing the math, and it...
Well, that doesn't make them cheap.
It seems skewed somehow. But I don't have any numbers, you know, to back it up, just kind of knowing how many there are and, you know, this $35 million total.
I just don't remember it like that.
Yeah, 36. That would be about 60,000 of it. 60,000 a parcel. Mm-hmm. So that might be. I did quick math here. I don't have my calculator. Yeah. So,
but it would not include the lakeshore because the permits don't cover lakeshore.
So,
well, in fact, if someone wants to camp, they can camp on the, you know, in your yard. Well, so.
Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, but for the record, it's not your yard, right? I mean...
Exactly.
You know, I'm sympathetic to this. I think it's a different argument than the county and the state thing. What I would say is the part where I think people start having, you know, members get concerned is I do think folks start thinking this is their land, and it isn't their land, and they know that when they buy them, and when they buy the permit. So... I think that does become part of the family tradition where people kind of feel like it's theirs and it's their lakeshore and they should be able to do these things, and really it is not theirs. And you know, I hate to have the committee start feeling like that because, you know, I just want to be clear on that. But I've told Representative Dietrich I agree with a lot of this bill, and because I think there's a better argument on the federal part than the state county. But, you know, it has to be clear. These are national lands that are owned in trust by everyone in the country. I mean, they're not anyone's yard, I guess. And I know it goes, we have a cabin too, and we look at Lake Superior, and it feels like my lake, but it's not. So I understand that. So I
appreciate that very much. Any last comment, then I'm going to go to Representative Dietrich. Mr. Forrester.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, I agree. I think, having spoken with a lot of these permit holders over the last year, I think the Forest Service is very good at reminding people with great regularity that they don't own the land. They're very clear about it and have a lot of meetings with people and are really forceful in enforcing sort of the restrictions that are on these lands.
Very good. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to close with reinforcing that the people who lease these federal lands do understand that they are really not their lands. There is really very little certainty with leasing this property. No permanent residency. There is no certainty that their lease will be renewed. The public has free access and unrestricted access to and around their property. They have many limitations on their cabins, the size, whether they can put another building on the leased property, the outbuildings, the colors of the exterior, the roofs, the fences, the gates. Satellites are not permitted. Yard lights are under some restrictions. Native plantings, only native plantings are permissible. The list really goes on, and I think that people would be really surprised. So I do have to agree with Mr. Forrester, is that they are probably reminded on quite a regular basis that these are not their lands. And but I just think, and I bring this bill forward because I think that this is just a much more equitable application of the property tax system in regards to government-owned lands. So I thank you for your time today, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate all the testifiers' testimony also. Representative Dietrich renews her motion to lay over House File 2234 as amended for possible inclusion in the commission report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have the last and final bill, House File 3440. Representative Dietrich, would you move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dietrich moves the bill, and she also has a DE1 amendment. Would you move the DE1 amendment?
Please, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dietrich moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion strongly prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right, we're working off the DE1 amendment. And, maybe, you know, on these DE1 amendments, I think it'd be nice initially because all of us have looked at this original one, and I haven't seen this. So tell me what the big difference is before you go into your bill.
Mr. Chairman, is a really good question. Last week I probably knew the answer to that question. Since we didn't do that bill last week, I did not take mental note this week.
Okay.
What the big difference?
Can anyone answer that question?
Ms. Baker.
Ms. Baker.
She was prepped on this bill last week also.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first thing is this DE amendment happened to be done last week, so we did have time to redo the House Research Bill summary, and the summary actually is to the DE amendment.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So you can actually look at it.
Oh,
and
very good.
The main change, and Mr. Rowe from Hennepin County can go into a lot more detail, but the main change from the original bill to this one is that on line 1.15, it was must be added to the tax, and this got changed to may be added to the tax. And
okay.
That probably is the biggest change. The other things are, I think, relatively technical and clarifying. Is that not right? But you can go through the bill. But that's the biggest change, is that must to may.
Thank you very much. Representative Dietrich, you've got a testifier.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I just want to make a general comment about House File 3440. It expands the method of payment of property taxes by allowing the county board, and I want to emphasize that allowing. It is not mandatory. It allows the county board by resolution to authorize the county treasurer to accept electronic payments. And it also provides that dishonored payments of the property taxes may be added to the tax and may be constituted as a lien in the same manner as as unpaid property taxes. So with that, this bill was brought forth by the Minnesota Association of County Auditors, Treasurers, and Financial Officers, and the Hennepin County has been a strong advocate of it. So we're going to go to our testifier, who is from Hennepin County, Ken Rowe.
Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Rowe, Hennepin County, R-O-W-E. And I am speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Auditors, Treasurers, and Finance Officers. The bill is simple. It does have two intents, and the first intent, less controversial, hopefully, is just affirmatively stating in law that we have the the authority to accept electronic funds transfer for the payment of property taxes. This is a practice that's been used for years now in Hennepin County and in many other counties. We've been accepting ACH payments through web payments for property taxes, and we're humbly asking that you have the law conform to our practice. The kind of the bigger change is that currently we do have the authority to, or the county board does have the authority to institute a fee for dishonored checks, and they're generally $30. That's a restriction in another part of the law. In Hennepin County, we currently don't assess these fees when it's for property taxes, and the reason is that the property tax is secured by a lien on the property, and the fee is not a part of that lien. And so if I were to bounce a check today for my property taxes, the county could assess me a fee, but I could come in tomorrow and pay my property taxes, and then they only have to pursue me for the collection of $30. And administratively, we can't pursue the collection of these fees. Maybe a phone call and one letter, and we pretty much used up all of the $30 that we would get out of the fee. And so in order to add weight behind this deterrent to writing bad checks and this payment for the fees that we incur for, or for the costs that we incur for processing these bad checks, we'd like to be able to attach that $30 to the property tax in much the same way that penalties, interest, publication costs, sheriff filing fees are currently attached to property taxes. It'll allow us to more efficiently collect those fees.
Any questions for testifier? Mr. Rule, thank you very much. Representative Dietrich, any last comments?
Thank you, Chairman. Members, it's late, so I will just be very quick. House File 3440 is, first of all, permissive, and it also would require a board resolution, so it is not a mandate. It does not impose any additional charges. It only attempts to improve county efficiency in collecting what already they have the ability to collect. And the amount of money that they're trying to collect is so small. So really what this does is it becomes a much more efficient way of collection of fees, and without the counties becoming collection agencies themselves. And I just want to also mention that the fees stay within the county. It does not get dispersed to other units of government.
Thank you very much. Representative Dietrich renews her motion to lay over House File 3440 as amended to be included, possible inclusion in the vision report.
Thank you
very much. Do we have any other business? Thank you, everyone, for your patience today. So we are adjourned.